It's a booming new market out in this new plane of competition and doesn't affect the business of the original players at all for a very long time. And the personal computer was one of these, right? So I remember when I got out of grad school, when I had to compute, I had to take my punched cards to the corporate mainframe center, and the expert ran the job for me. And because it was so expensive and inconvenient, we didn't compute very much. But when the personal computer was introduced, it was so inexpensive and so idiot simple that an idiot like me could now begin to compute for himself in the convenience of my own office. And at the beginning, out here in this new plane of competition, those early PCs could barely do word processing. But because I hadn't been able to do anything myself, I was delighted to have something that wasn't very good. And then as the PC and the software associated with it got better and better and better out in this third plane of competition, ultimately it got good enough that it started to then suck applications out of the back plane into the new plane. And little by little, the customers left the established players. And so the effect of the disruption was the same in that the established leaders got killed. It just is kind of a different animal, bringing something that is so much more affordable and simple than a whole new group of people can now begin to do it for themselves. And I want to just illustrate with this with a couple of examples from history and then think through how open source software might be affected by this principle. This is the historical example. The transistor was a disruptive innovation relative to the vacuum tube because when it emerged in the late 40s and early 50s, it simply couldn't handle the power that was required to be used in the markets that existed at the time, the big tabletop radios and floor-standing televisions and so on. Every one of the vacuum tube companies took a license to the transistor, but they carried the license into their laboratories and they framed it as a technological deficiency. In other words, the transistor isn't good enough yet to be used in the market. And if you could go back and get all of the expenses out of these companies, they probably in aggregate spent $2 billion in today's dollars investing, trying to make solid-state electronics good enough that you could make big products out of them. Now, while they were trying to do that, over here, now I'm going to collapse this back into two dimensions, but when you see green, I really mean that that's taking root out here in a third plane of competition. The first application was a germanium transistor hearing aid in 1952. Tiny little market, but it valued it for the very attributes that made it useless in the mainstream, and that was low power consumption. And then in 1955, Sony introduced its first pocket radio. And those of you with gray hair remember how crummy those things were, just static-laced, very low fidelity, wouldn't get a signal from much of a distance. But Sony chose to sell the pocket radio to kind of the rebar of humanity, people we call teenagers. And the teenagers were delighted to have a product that was not very good because their alternative was no radio at all. And it allowed them to do something that they had wanted to do but never could do, and that is listen to rock and roll out of the earshot of their parents. And so a booming new market emerged in this third plane of competition. And these guys back here felt no pain because they were all new customers. Had Sony tried to sell its pocket radio to the parents, a crummy product would have been judged to be crummy because they had an alternative of a high-quality vacuum tube radio. Then in 1959, Sony introduced its first portable television. And again, they competed against non-consumption. They made it so affordable and simple that a whole new population of households who didn't have a big enough apartment to have the big floor-standing TV or didn't have enough money to buy one, now they could own one. And because the alternative was no TV at all, they were delighted with a crummy product. And again, a booming new market emerged in this third plane of competition until the mid-1960s. And now solid-state electronics was good enough that it could handle the power required to be used in making these big devices. And bam, within 3 years, all of the applications got sucked out into the solid-state world. And the vacuum tube companies were just dead. And these are venerable institutions like RCA. The punishing thing is that it's not that they didn't see the technology coming. They saw it before Sony did. It's not that they weren't aggressive and visionary. They invested far more money trying to make the technology good enough than did Sony as they were building these growth businesses. The punishing thing is that they targeted the wrong customers. They targeted consumers. And the only way the customers here would have adopted the new technology is if it were better than the old technology or more cost effective. And that was a very demanding technical hurdle for the vacuum tube companies to surmount. As they came out and competed against non-consumption, in contrast, Sony had a much more modest performance hurdle because they just had to make a product that was better than nothing, and the customers were delighted. Now, where you see this happening today is voice recognition software. So the next time you go to a computer superstore, go to the voice recognition software shelf and pick up a box there that's called the IBM Via Voice. Now, don't buy it, but just look at it. They have a picture of the customer on the box. And it's an administrative assistant who's sitting in front of her computer wearing a headset speaking rather than word processing. And think about the value proposition that IBM has to be making to this woman. She types 90 words a minute. She's 99% accurate. If she needs to capitalize something, she just instinctively presses shift and cruises through. And IBM has to say, no, don't do that anymore. I want you to put this headset on and teach yourself to speak in a slow and distinct and consistent manner in complete sentences. If you must capitalize, you must pause. Speak the command, capitalize, pause. Speak the word you want to capitalize, pause. Speak the command, uncapitalize, pause. Please be patient. We are 70% accurate. This will get better, we promise. This is not an attractive proposition to this customer. And IBM has, I've not worked with them at all, but as I understand it, has spent maybe $700 million trying to make voice recognition technology good enough that it can be used in that market. This is a very difficult technical hurdle to surmount. Meanwhile, while they're investing that aggressively, Lego comes up with these robots that recognize stop, go left, right, and the kids are thrilled with the four-word vocabulary. And then press or say one kinds of applications take root, and now directory assistants ask you to say the city and state and so on. And much simpler and kind of an interesting market is emerging. I bet maybe the next place it takes root is in chat rooms because the kids don't spell check or capitalize anyway. And they would rather speak than type. And maybe then the next application would be, you know, when you see these stubby-fingered executives with their BlackBerries trying to peck out emails and their fingers are four times the diameter of the keys, and they're only 70% accurate. If somebody gave them a voice recognition algorithm that was really didn't have to be very good so that they could speak their wireless email rather than peck it out, I bet they'd be thrilled with a crummy product. And ultimately, as it takes root in these new applications, it may get good enough that we can do word processing with it, but it'll be a long time. And I've asked myself, why would the IBM engineers have picked off the most demanding application conceivable for this technology? And it probably resides in the resource allocation process of the company. Because it's not just IBM, everybody does it. You got to rule out stupidity because they're at least as smart as us. But in order to get funded, the people who had the idea knew that they just couldn't stand up in front of senior management without PowerPoint and just say, I'm sure there's going to be a lot of press or say one stuff happens sometime. They never get funded. But they have to do a PowerPoint presentation that has financial projections. And they have to be able to say that we hired a consulting firm and they did a market study. And, you know, there are 37.9 million administrative assistants who spend this many hours a day word processing. And this is how big the market is. And in order to get funded, it forces the company to target the market that ultimately causes them to fail. And the digital camera people, like Kodak, fell victim to the same process. As digital cameras are potentially disruptive, and so in order to make a digital camera good enough that people would opt to take a digital rather than a film image, they have to cram it full of charge-coupled devices. And that drives the price point up so high that the only people who can afford to buy a digital camera are people who own film cameras. And so then the reward for success, once they got a good enough digital camera, is they don't sell film. So a massive investment and no growth. And meanwhile, we see taking root out in a third plane of competition, credit card thickness cameras that have just dirt cheap CMOS sensors. And now CMOS sensor-based imagers in cell phones that take crummy images, but they're so much better than nothing at all, that a booming new market is emerging. And whether a disruption creates new growth or a threat to the core business, in many ways, is driven by this very same thing. Our daughter just finished a mission for our church in Mongolia, where she'd been for a couple of years. And we went over to get her in August when she finished her service. And I'd always wondered whether solar energy was ever going to be commercially viable, because the European and American governments have probably invested $15 billion trying to make solar energy good enough that we could use it in our markets. If you think about it, this is a very difficult technical hurdle, because our homes are filled with air conditioners and power-sucking computers and microwave ovens, and you got minor problems like nights and clouds that get in the way, and it's a very difficult problem. And so the technology making solar cells with this as the core market that they envision is very expensive and optimized to try to wring the most power possible out of the materials and technology that are available. Anyway, when we were in Mongolia, our daughter took us to this big open-air market in the capital city, Ulaanbaatar. There's this big line of stalls in this market where the vendors are selling dirt-cheap solar cells, shrink-wrapped with 6-inch televisions and rabbit ears antennas. And they're just walking out of the marketplace. And so, because half the population of Mongolia doesn't have access to power over a grid. And it doesn't really matter if it was cloudy today. I couldn't watch TV yesterday. And there are about 2 billion people in South Asia and Africa who don't have access to electric power at all. And it turns out they don't have air conditioners and microwave ovens in their homes. And they're delighted with something that won't be very good. And whether solar energy ever takes root as a viable commercial technology, I don't think we'll ever get driven in the sophisticated engineering labs of North America and Europe, but it'll be by folks out there in the third plane of competition, competing against non-consumption and getting better and better all the time. So as I look at how different companies have tried to deploy Linux, what this would suggest is that if IBM tries to shove Linux down Merrill Lynch's throat in its core internal mainframe computer system, there are just so many complicated interdependencies when you insert a new technology into an existing system of use that you run into all kinds of problems. But I think at that end of the world, where you see open source taking root is in web servers, which is a totally new application kind of taking root out here in internet-based computing. And as it gets better and better and sucks applications out of an internal system to a web-based model, then gradually Linux disrupts as a new market disruption Unix in those tiers of the market. But it does it not by a direct attack, but by taking root in a new application. And similarly, what it would forecast, and again, I say this is just what the model says, is that any attempt to deploy Linux right onto a desktop, there are just so many complicated and unforeseeable interdependencies when you insert an existing technology, a new technology into an existing system of use. So many other subtle things would have to change And it would have to become better than the existing thing in the ways that the consumer measures goodness. I wouldn't expect it to take root. But because of the law of conservation of modularity, as it takes root out in the new plane of competition with wireless handheld devices, because the modularity of Linux allows the device to become optimized, and then as it gets better and better, applications get sucked off the desktop into the handheld device, and that would be the mechanism by which the Microsoft proprietary operating system would get disrupted by Linux. I mean, that's, I don't know if that's true, but that's what the model would predict. Well, there are a bunch of other questions that we didn't answer, but I hope this kind of gives you a flavor of at least the way we've been trying to think our way through some of these problems. And this book that we wrote about at The Innovator's Solution gives the models that address the other questions. If you have any interest, they're there, or I just work at our business school. It won't get finished off for another 20 years. Disruption is a process, not an event. So you could contact me at Harvard if you have any other questions. Anyway, criticisms or barbs or... Yes. Uh-huh.
That fits into the model you presented of rolling out the kind of crummy Linux desktop in a country which doesn't have anything done.
Yes, that would work, kind of, you know, in that it's so much better than nothing, and it's a new system of use to an extent. The problem is if in fact, they bump into existing systems of use, and that is... application software that just don't run well on that, then you'd expect them to run into problems. But China is a much easier place to deploy it than existing markets. Yes? Well, yeah, that's a great question. Can I give you a longer answer than you asked for? When we were having this case discussion about the disruption of the Harvard Business School, I walked into the classroom and took a vote of the students. There were 100 students in the class. How many of you think Harvard's in trouble? 3 students raised their hand. 97, there were no abstentions, voted that, don't worry, be happy, this could never happen to our school. And so I asked one of the 3 who was worried why he was worried, and he said, well, there's a real pattern here. And he lists out the elements of the pattern, and then he said, now look in the case, and everything that happened to all of these other people is happening to us. That's why I'm worried. So then I turned to the don't worry, be happy crowd and said, so why aren't you worried? Because it fits the pattern so closely. And everything that they cited related to the data, that more people are applying to Harvard than ever before, our students are getting more money than ever before, the more money they get paid, the higher, we're much further ahead of Stanford on the rankings and so on. So we had this argument back and forth, and so then I asked one of the students who was the most vociferous defenders of Harvard's invincibility, So imagine you were dean of the school. What evidence would you need to see to become convinced that this is a problem that we need to address? And he said, well, I'd look at Harvard's market share amongst the CEOs of the global 1,000 corporations. And if it starts to dip, then I'd worry. And I said, well, when you saw that data, would it signal that the problem needs to be addressed or that the game is over? He said, oh, yeah, the game would be over. And so I turned to the rest of the don't worry, be happy crowd and said, so any of the rest of you, imagine you were dean. Could you give me data that would convince you that it was time to take action? And actually, every piece of data that they could come up with was evidence that the game was over. And kind of the idiot simple insight that we got is that data is only available about the past. And yet, the way we teach our students is, you know, we at our school, we teach by the case method. And if the student makes a comment in a case discussion, that can't be backed up by his analysis of the data in the case. The instructors are trained to crucify the student on the spot. And so we enshrine the virtues of data-driven analytical decision-making in the way we teach at our business schools, and then our students go to work for McKinsey, and they carry data-driven analytics to the nth degree. But in many ways, the very ways we teach them condemns our managers to take action when the game is over. But the scary thing for Harvard is that this means that we need to take action based upon a theory, not evidence. And that's how I got into this thing that, well, crumb, we're always using a theory anyway, because it's a theory is a statement of cause and effect. But we just hope we have better theories. So at the time IBM made the decision, there was no theory to guide them. There was only evidence of the past, and the evidence of the past was that the money was made at the system, not in the components. And now, as you have a theory, you know, hopefully it's a good theory, then it allows companies who face this transition to make a decision about whether they ought to create an interdependent or a modular architecture and when it's going to flip. You know, for example, what's going on right now with wireless access to the internet, it's not good enough. It needs a proprietary system. And so companies that have tried to cobble together a system around WAP standards, for example, it's prematurely modular. And the companies that have an interdependent system, like Docomo and JPhone in Japan, they're making bundles of money, and they're also out, you know, competing against non-consumption for the business of teenagers. So I just hope, that's what I hope to accomplish, is that we can look into the future and make statements about what will happen before the data is clear. But in the past, that hasn't been possible. Yes, Tim?
Yeah, I have a question about the sort of the theory of conservation, how that might relate effectively to the breakup value of the software that the company wants to open source. Now, I would remember when Sun was deciding to make Star Office.
Yeah, I think it would be, Tim. In other words, but you have to think of it in relative terms. So what is it in that system, in the value chain of the system that gets delivered to the customer is not good enough? And that tells you then what has to be optimized. And you've got to be integrated across that interface that optimizes it. And what's next to it then needs to be broken up. And that's, but it, you're thinking about it, I think, in a healthy way. Yes?
As a Stanford guy.
Speak loud.
As a Stanford guy, I won't hold those comments against you. Is your theory predictive? Is the problem that's basically disappearing every market, or is the theory more that the problem is made, but they just are made by different markets?
Yeah. Yes, his question is, does the theory predict that the profits will disappear in every market or that they will just be made by different parties? And it's very much the latter. In fact, for marketing purposes, we called this concept the law of conservation of modularity. In the book, we called it the law of conservation of attractive profits. So at one layer, as it moves towards commoditization by overshooting and becoming modular, the adjacent layers move towards decommoditization. And so the ability to make money will shift. Now, so like in the car industry, the subsystems, the tier one suppliers, are not yet manifestly more profitable than the car assemblers. But we should see that transition occurring over the next few years as the power in that industry shifts and so on. Yes?
How will the conservation of modularity work in open source software? How will you predict what's going to flip when the summer comes to modify the operating system and talk about databases, others are trying to modify databases, and talk about applications, others are trying to modify applications, talk about services. How do you predict what's going to flip?
Well, that was a I don't think I can repeat your statement, but I hope everybody heard it. I think the concept is that when you have a modular architecture, it truly is undifferentiable because the pieces fit together in a pattern that everybody follows, and so the product is not differentiable. And in a disintegrated industry structure, the cost structure of the company is heavily variable because you outsource the components. Okay, and so a variable cost structure means that the scale curve is flat. So small companies and large companies have the same cost, and the product is undifferentiable. And that's why it's very hard to make money as an assembler of a modular system. In a proprietary system, it's just the opposite, that the proprietary architecture yields a highly differentiable product, and it's a heavy fixed cost because the design of a proprietary product is expensive. And so that creates steep scale economics, meaning that the big players sell a that's a recipe for minting money versus not making money. And so whether MySQL gets kind of folded in to optimize the next, you know, some other application, or Linux gets folded into some other application, or they try to fold an application into the operating system, where the money will be made is where you're optimizing the performance of something that is not yet good enough. And that's really all I can say. Because then that creates a condition in which a proprietary architecture will win. And that's where money gets made. So I got to believe that a lot of money stays in the system, but it just gets made at a different level.
I have a comment.
It better be a good comment.
I'm the guy from MySQL, and I would say that the place where
this merits a microphone here.
Yes, sir. I'm the guy from MySQL, and I'd like to. I think that the value is, thank you, being produced in the layer above the infrastructure. So in web services specifically. So look at Amazon, Yahoo, Google, who all use standardized open source modular components that they pay virtually nothing for, and then they create a highly interdependent system with a very high value that they can sell out to customers, and they make much more money than the open source players. So I guess that's part of an answer.
Yeah. Great, thank you. There in the middle. Northeast, yeah. Microsoft's in the Northwest.
Actually, Microsoft is here. Oh. So my question is Microsoft going to flee, or are they going to do like you described with Quantum and Plus, where they're going to like spin off another little thing, and then they're going to buy out 20% of Plus?
Yeah, well, boy, I will just conjecture because I don't consult for them or anything like that. But the NT is a disruption relative to Unix, right? And that system has just been moving up market and squeezing the Unix and the RISC world up to the high end of the market. And then Linux on web servers has kind of inserted itself there. And it's an interesting question whether in the absence of Linux, I think Microsoft would have had a really exhilarating, there was a lot of headroom above them. Whether Linux kind of limits the further up market march as applications move to a web-based system, I don't know. I also think that it's just very hard for me to imagine the core franchise of operating systems on a desktop is being threatened in the foreseeable future because of the reasons that we've talked about. Now, the growth markets, they may very well have a difficult time catching. I also see them launching their own disruptions against other folks, which is really a great idea. And so they've got database software coming up against Oracle, and they've got Great Plains that SAP needs to be disrupted. They're very complicated, high-end, overshot, interdependent system. And there's a lot of growth there. And so they're doing a lot of interesting and useful things. But I think the critical thing, as per what he said, is if they want to keep being profitable, there's a mindset that, you know, while we milk the operating system business over here, in the future, operating system is not where the money will be made. And so don't somehow try to make money off of Linux. Use Linux to somehow optimize the next layer up and shift how we make money there. But they're a tough company and a good company. Yes.
My question is about switching costs. Not in the one where you start the new line of business, but in the one where a lower cost comes in and attacks. Yeah. In that case, switching costs seems to me to have the effect of the diagram of moving the curves further apart. And that's clearly what, for instance, Defense Office against Open Office is attempts to tie it in and keeping the switching costs very high.
Yeah, that's a very good point. And that's why the cramming it into the blue space so often is expensive and fails. Whereas if you take root in a whole new plane of competition, you don't run into the switching cost problem out there. And it's like this: the best shortest distance between two points is not a straight line. Yes. Well, of course I think it's a perfect theory. I would have changed it, right? No, that it is the only way you can develop a better theory is to find anomalies that the theory won't explain. And so I'll tell you what I do think is that these pressures... are you familiar with the story of the mini-mill? So in the new book, I understood that a lot better and told the deeper story. But as the mini mills hit the rebar market, because they had a 20% cost advantage, they made tons of money. And of course, the integrated mills, because there were more profitable investments up, they got out of that business. And it felt great until 1979, when the mini mills finally had the whole market to themselves. And then the price collapsed by 20% because the insight I got was that a low-cost strategy is only viable as long as there's a high-cost competitor around. And so they had to move up because that's where the high-cost competitor was. And that's why Dell has to race up market because it gives it the privilege of competing against Sun Microsystems. Now, so I would say that those pressures to move up exist on everybody. Now, some companies, like in the pharmaceutical industry, they haven't yet overshot very much. And so, you know, the forces are there. It just hasn't played itself out. In other industries, there are anomalies that I think you can explain. So let me tell about this, and then there's some that I don't understand yet. Airlines. Southwest Airlines was a new market disruption. Is that when they started out, they were competing against buses and cars, not against United. And so they, just like Walmart locked up the little cities, Southwest locked up the point-to-point routes between the little cities. And they've done okay. But all of the other discount airlines have come in as a low-end disruptor, not a new market disruptor, hitting the low end of the main market. So like the latest is JetBlue. And they're flying in and out of mainstream airports. And it's easy for a discount airline to create a low-cost structure. You just buy fully depreciated jets and hire non-union people and so on. And you notice how many discount airlines have started over the last 20 years, and their average life expectancy is about 4 years. is they hit the low end of the market, and it looks like, you know, a classic disruption. The problem is for the major airlines, their cost structure is such that they cannot live without the volume at the low end of the market. And so the discounters can gain a little share, and then the major airlines just have to set up shuttle by United or Song and swat them down. And then as soon as the discounter has gone out of business, then they shut down shuttle by United and go back up, you know. And so it's an eminently disruptible business, but the incumbents can't flee. They have to fight. And so it makes it miserable for everybody except Southwest, that's out there kind of in its own little world. So that's an anomaly, which I actually think the theory can explain. I can't explain, for example, why EMC beat IBM. It wasn't a disruptive technology. It was a better product, and yet they cleaned them out. And there are a couple like that, but I think it's a pretty pervasive phenomenon. Religion, I haven't applied it to churches yet. But.
How does this apply for Intel?
It's a great question. Intel, how does this apply to Intel? So they were, you know, they were getting killed at the low end. And they then developed what they call the Celeron chip and tried to sell it through the sales force. The problem was the sales force had a problem because when they're trying to get a design win, say at Dell, they had to choose, should we spend our energy trying to get a design win for a $300 Pentium processor that gives us 80% margins, or should we get a design win for a $50, $70 processor that yields 30% margins? You just can't, you know. So they set up a separate marketing organization out of Israel and gave it the responsibility to sell the Celeron chip and gave it a cost structure so that a $70 price point was attractive. And as soon as they put good technology in a business model that found the disruption attractive, bam, and they got the low end of the market back again. Cyrix is gone. AMD was nailed to the wall. And now the Celeron is the highest volume of all of the products in the line. And now the next thing that's happening is the system on a chip, the modular custom configured processor that needs to be delivered very rapidly. And they've got a fab in Marlboro, Mass. With their strong arm technology trying to do that. And I think this disruption, it's a new market disruption here, is a bigger deal. Yeah, they're really, and that's the evidence that the incumbents actually don't need to get killed, but they got to set up a separate organization that can focus on the new thing. And the reason you have to set it up separately is that the new game begins before the old game ends. And if you try to do the new thing within the established, then you take your eye off the old game, and there's still a lot of money to be made there. There's a company in Santa Clara called Tensilica that I think is very interesting. That, you know, in the new market disruption, what happens, I'll give you an analogy of how this works, because I think it's a big deal for the software industry. If you go back 30 or 50 years ago in organic chemistry, if you wanted a new molecule, you had to go to the labs at DuPont. And they employed the finest organic chemists in the world, and one of them would mix up a few atoms in a beaker and heat it up and draw a fiber out and look at it under a microscope and then go down and talk to a colleague and say, what do you think this is? And the colleague would say, I have no idea, but heat it up for 10 more minutes and let's see what happens. And the miracle molecules that we know as nylon and polyester and Kevlar emerged from an unstructured trial and error problem-solving process in the labs at DuPont. And nobody could do this like DuPont or like the engineers who were at DuPont. You just had to be the best experts in the world. But as they kept doing this over and over, they began to recognize patterns of cause and effect. And when that realm of knowledge migrated out of an unstructured experimental problem-solving mode down into pattern recognition, then you didn't have to be nearly the world's experts in order to make molecules. And so other companies like Dow and Union Carbide and so on could get into the plastics business. And then quantum theory took over. And quantum theory allows you, I'm going to overstate the case a little bit, allows you to predict that if you put the atoms together in this structure in the molecule, these will be the properties of the material. And that then allows you to write a piece of software to reverse engineer. So if you need these properties, this is what the molecule has to be structured like. And so now you really just need a BS in chemical engineering from Montana State and a good piece of software, and you can design better molecules faster and at lower cost than the world's experts could a generation ago, because it's gone from unstructured problem solving to pattern recognition down to a rules-based. And in many ways, the progression from interdependence to modular follows that same thing. So in a world of interdependence, you just need the best experts in the world, and through trial and error and working things out, they create great systems. And modularity that defines how the pieces snap together is only possible when it's done more of in a rules-based world. And that allows now people with much less skill to do very sophisticated things, because the technology is more rules-based. So what Tensilica is doing is the software that allows their customers to create custom-configured processors tailored exactly to each situation. Their target is to make it so idiot simple to design a custom-configured processor that even a software engineer could design a processor to optimize the application. I think that's kind of slick. But you can now that the functionality is more than good enough and you can back off the frontier and the rules are not yet there, but they're emerging, it could really change a lot of the world for somebody like Intel. And another thing is that as the law of conservation and modularity works its way through, Intel needs to be an integrated company, because at the high end, you cannot, there's not a clean design and manufacturing interface. But at the low end, there are much better defined rules for design and manufacture. And so the fabless companies and the focused fabs are kind of taking over. It would be crazy if as that disintegrated industry structure works its way up market, it would be crazy for Intel to sell off its fabs. And its finance people are going to want to sell them off because they're so capital intensive, but the fab is the place where the money will be made, if they're fast, I think. Yes? Her question is, what happens if these market disruptors get bought by big players and by the incumbents? It actually is a great strategy. I'll say two things. Companies like Johnson & Johnson, as the healthcare industry is getting disrupted in a pretty big way. We don't have time to talk about it. But they've kind of decided we're not good at getting these things off the ground. But they've got a team of people that have these like lenses on, going around the healthcare industry, identifying little companies that are new market disruptors. And so a company that has a technology that will allow you to do in the home what today you have to do in an office, or it'll allow you to do in an office what today you have to do in a hospital, that's a new market disruption. And they're actively trying to buy them. And then if they keep it separate and let them have their own processes and create their own business model and just give them their money, it's a great way to generate growth. And J&J has generated, now every year they get about $9 billion of revenue from disruptive companies that they bought a decade ago. If they try to fold the company into the parent, then it destroys what they bought, because it has to conform to the business model of the parent. Could I fit the University of Phoenix into the Harvard Business School's picture? Yes, it is exactly one of those things. It's exactly one of those things. And there's a not good enough, but but there are 160,000 students at the University of Phoenix getting management degrees of one sort or another online. And it's getting better and better every year. And it's the students that they cater to are not people who would have gone to a leading MBA program anyway. You know, and therefore they're really quite happy to be able to do something that's online and ostensibly not as good. But geez, they're getting good. Well, it's a good question. He said, so the University of Phoenix is not something that Harvard should go after. If you go back to the model of skating to where the money will be, in the past, see, Harvard is an integrated institution. We do the research. The research gets embodied in components that we call cases and articles. We assemble the components into courses. We produce the courses, we market the courses, we soak our students for money to finance the courses and everything. And the architecture of the MBA program is interdependent. And so you can't study marketing if you don't study product development. And you can't study product development if you don't study manufacturing. And you can't study manufacturing if you don't study cost accounting. And you can't study cost accounting if you don't study organization design. Because management's a big hairball. And you got to study all of it in order to understand any of it. But online or corporate education is modular. And so somebody will call up corporate training and say, geez, we've got to give a strategy presentation to the board in June. Can you give us a week of strategy? And it's not as good as Michael Porter's course, but it does a job. And then they learn a little strategy and go practice it, and then they call up and say, we've got to get better in product development. Can you find us 2 weeks of product development and so on? And on that side, in a modular world, where the money is made is not in the teaching of the courses, the assembly of the course. In our world, that's where the money has been made. In that world, if Harvard could become the Intel Inside of every corporate university, and I'll put my tongue in my cheek, if we could make it foolproof for all of these unwashed instructors in corporate training programs to teach great stuff in compelling ways, we'll create so much growth in education, and we would still make all the money in the industry. But it's a very different business model than what we have now. But that would be the right play. But we don't have any data to support that. should we do just one more question? And then, well, we better not talk afterwards. Guys, thanks for wasting the end of your day with me. It's been very helpful.
Thank you for listening to this special edition of IT Conversations. This edition was recorded at the Open Source Business Conference held in San Francisco in March 2004. For more information regarding this and future OSBC conferences, please visit www.osbc.com. IT Conversations is a production of RDS Strategies, LLC. This program is copyright 2004 by the presenter, Open Source Business Conference, and RDS Strategies, LLC. My name is Doug Kaye, and I hope you'll join me next time for another edition of IT Conversations.